Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.
We can Nigerian energy, bringing Nigerian diaspora up to speed.
He was born on the 20th of January 1979, known professionally as Teju Babyface. Is a Nigerian comedian and talk show host. He's credited with giving Nigeria its first offering of late-night talk television with the multi-award-winning The Teju Babyface Show. Oyelakin is a United Nations Sustainable Development Goals Ambassador for Nigeria with a focus on decent work and economic growth. In 2017, Oyelakin published the book Secrets of the Streets, 23 Secrets for Achieving Success with Talent. In 2018, with Forget Principles, Find a Mentor, How to Connect with the People Who Will Help You Get from Where You Are to Where You Need to Be in Life. He started his career as both an actor and a comedian, and now produces and runs a talk show, The Teju Babyface Show. Whilst a member of Theatre 15, he was cast as the main character in Tadi Oginor's movie Diamond Ring 1998. Whilst the film was successful, Oyelakin did not receive any more film roles. Later, he took a friend up on an offer to act as the MC for a departmental end of year whilst in university, and henceforth focused more on comedy and was rewarded with success. In 2010, Oyelakin developed the Teju Babyface Show. In production for its sixth season, the show has played host to celebrities and personalities. In May 2017, he published the book Secrets of the Streets. In September 2012, Oyelakin married Oluwatobiloba Banjoko, and they are both blessed with a set of twins. His fan base has amassed almost 600,000 followers on Facebook. I'm sure that number has increased. And he has gone on several comedy tours across the U.S., Nigeria, and only God knows where else. Sashino! How are you? This is what my family calls him. Sorry, I have to first use that. So people, don't be confused. We are actually speaking to Teju Babyface. Welcome to the show. Why can we not hear you? We can't hear you. Can you hear us? I can hear myself. Hold on. Why we change our speaker? Yes, I think we can. We will probably be able to hear him now. Can you hear? Can we? We can hear you now.
I'm just messing with you out here.
Yeah, do what?
I'm just messing with you out here.
Oh,
Mama, can you imagine?
For Lajin, what's wrong with you? This is why you're a comedian, Abi. Can you imagine that? It was him. He was using us to do comedy show. Oh, shalom.
All right.
It is so great to finally have you. And you know how the Lord works. You plan and plan and plan, or rather, me, I planned and planned and planned. Alas, you were slated for the last Saturday in December in the year 2020. Isn't that just remarkable?
Yeah, I mean, it's a year where my birthday is actually 2020. So January 2020.
That's so true. So, brother, how are you?
I'm sleepy.
I can imagine. What time is it on your end? It's like, what, 5 a.m., maybe?
6, actually.
You should be used to waking up at this kind of time now. You have two children. There's no way that you manage to sleep.
Why? Am I a farmer? Waking up at 6.
No, but you have two young children, so there's no way that you can be sleeping at 7 o'clock in the morning. They will wake you up.
My wife has actually been kind enough to absolve me of most of that keeping awake responsibility.
Oh.
You know, when it comes to sleeping with the kids.
Oh.
I mean, not like she has any choice. The little blessings don't want to sleep with me. So, yeah.
I wonder why. I mean,
you know, there's no
person.
They don't know. Maybe when I stop paying for stuff, they will understand.
Is that you wish? That's something that you wish you could do, but you probably will never do. knowing the son of whom.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I don't even wish that. I mean, it's a blessing, you know.
I can imagine.
It's a joy.
It must be. It must be. So tell us, why comedy? I mean, we know why comedy. It's not that you couldn't have made a career in acting, but obviously you had a clear view. It seems, with hindsight, that you had a clear view of what it was you wanted to achieve with your life, the impact you wanted to make. So why did you choose comedy over acting, which you had your, so to speak, first break in?
Well, it's because my career has been sort of, sorry, I'll be yawning very
loud. Okay, yeah, you man, we forgive you.
Okay, so, because my career has been providential in a way. It's been quite funny the way it has played out, because I didn't have a choice in some of the things that happened. For example, I appeared in this movie that was Diamond Ring, and it was about the biggest movie of the year, and I was in the lead role. And so, when I, you know, did that movie, everybody assumed that, you know, I was set in acting for life. I mean, if you appear in a Tadio Bidon movie as the lead actor, and, you know, I mean, that's it. That's the equivalent of appearing in a Steven Spielberg movie in the United States in the lead role as your first movie.
True.
You know, so that was it. Except that wasn't it. Because after the movie, I just couldn't get any acting roles. I mean, I went around for auditions. I went from place to place. I learned yesterday that Chikwueju passed away.
Yes.
May his soul rest in peace. But I remember that I went to his office as well. He was out of the country. And then I went to his brother's office, the Bijiro, for an audition. And, you know, I was just treated like a nobody. Anyway, so that didn't happen for a while. And I remember that it was when I stepped into Fred Amata's office that Fred Amata was by mile the nicest person. Fred saw me and looked at me and said, he said, why do you look familiar? I said, I just acted in Tadio Bidon's Diamond Ring. And whereupon he said, you don't craze. Sit down.
And that is so Fred.
So I sat down and said, hey, what you go drink? You know, give me a bottle of something. So they gave me a Fanta. And so he said, hey, what can I do for you? So I said, look, bros, I've been in this movie now. It's been over 6 months. Nothing has happened. I was hoping perhaps I could get something from you. He said, nothing has happened. I mean, after all, you played that wonderful role. I mean, despite the fact that you were so great in that great film, nothing happened. I said, yes. He said, He said, I can tell you why, though.
Ooh.
He said, you are doubly disadvantaged. He said, first of all, you started your career where most people end theirs.
Right.
He said, everybody works all their lives. Most people work all their lives in the industry hoping to get a chance to star, in a Tadio Bidon movie. You know, they work all their lives hoping to get a chance to star in a Tadio Bidon movie. Tadio Bidon, who, by the way, does a movie once every 4 years or so. And here you come out of the blocks in the lead role in a Tadio Bidon movie. I said, so, he said, so where, you know how they say the sky is not the limit? He said, literally here, the sky is the limit.
He said, so
where do you go from here? He said, the only chance is remain in working with the other two big directors. He said, you know, we have only three. We have Tadio Bidon, we have Amaka Igwe, and we have Tunde Kelani. And those three have just one thing, they have something in common. They release movies sparingly, once every 4 years, once every 5 years. So that's a problem. He said, secondly, and perhaps more importantly, you have come into an industry that is traditional in the way it's cast. He said, for example, now all we're doing are ritualistic movies. He said, I'm ashamed to admit it, but that's what we're doing. And that was when they were doing all the Izuzu, Igada, Igogo, Igbaba,
Igogo,
in the bush, you know, paint your faces black.
True.
That movie. He said, so look at you. I mean, he said, look at you, fine boy, undergraduate, well brought up, University of Lagos. I mean, what part are you going to be cast?
Exactly.
You don't fit the will of the times. He says, oh man, that's unfortunate. And so I stopped looking for roles after that. I just went back to school and it occurred to me somewhere along the line that I was funny. And TA was the reason why, because TA was in the same hall, we were in the same group, acting group in school, we were friends, he was a year ahead of me. And I just saw how his comedy career blossomed over time. And what occurred to me was that a comedian could exert more influence over his career than an actor. You know, a comedian didn't need anybody to really cast him in a role before he could act. Yes, I mean, he would still need to get the parties from people and get the role, I mean, and get the stage from people. But, I mean, T.A. was doing so well. He used to, I mean, I remember how I'd be at home on, say, Christmas Day, for example, and how I'd be bored out of my mind. And I put on the radio and Ray Power just started then and I'd hear, you know, Christmas show live at the whatever, Akia National Street, Victoria Live featuring the Plantation Boys, King Sonny Ade, your MC, T.A. and Ali Baba. I'd be like, God damn it. I'd be like, this boy's enjoying, you know. In front of my eyes there in University of Lagos, Brooke T.A. just transformed his life. He bought one car first, then he bought another car in the space of 1 year. He moved out of the hall, moved out into a BQ, went to, I mean, I'm like, what, man, I'm done with this acting thing. So that's how I just come. But this is where Providence comes in. Even though I was done with acting, acting wasn't done with me. Because, strangely enough, I got another role. I just came into my hall one day. I found a script at my door. A producer from town had tracked me down to University of Lagos. He wanted me to come to read for, a role they'd be having for a series for TV. And I went, I got the role. In fact, they didn't even audition me. They just cast me straight. I got the role. Oh. We acted that for quite a few months in First Act. Was on the set of that show that I met an unknown young actor who thought I was a star and thought that I should have done more with Diamond Ring. And I told him that I couldn't do more. I tried my best, but he thought, no, I should have done more. He kept telling me that if he had had that opportunity, he would have done more and so on and so forth. And I guess he was right, because his name was Desmond Elliott, and he went to do more. Yeah, that's how I met Desmond Elliott as an unknown quantity in when we were acting in the year 2000 in a series called One Too Much. Wow. So the series was on TV for a while. And then I was acting on stage. In fact, we're acting on stage in Bumi Davies's, what was that play?
The Devil is a Woman? There was that.
Oh, yeah, there you go. The Devil is a Woman. Yes.
There were a few
others. So you and I were acting on stage at the Movesong Center. About this time, I was working on my comedy career. You know, I was working on my comedy career. It might have been 2000. No, it wasn't 2001. It was 2001. So we're acting at the Movesong Center, and we finished one of the plays. And Bumi Davies rushed up to me after the curtain call, and he says, Amaka Igwe wants to meet you. I said, who? He said, Amaka Igwe was in the audience. I'm like, what? Nigeria's James Cameron? She was in the audience? Wow. So I went to meet her and her husband Charles in the foyer. And they said, I mean, they liked what I did and they were casting for a series. And they wanted me to audition. Now, when Amaka Igwe tells you she's casting for a series, I mean, you don't sleep again. Amaka Igwe casting for a series. Amaka Igwe literally made the careers of Richard Mufedamijo and a couple of other people in Checkmate a couple of years before that. So I went to our office to read for the role, and it turns out they were casting for the lead role in another series. This was some 8 years, almost a decade after she had done Checkmate, and she was looking to do another television series that would be bigger than Checkmate, and she wanted to cast me in the lead role. So they had shortlisted two other people already until she saw me on stage, which was strange because that was exactly how Diamond Ring worked out. Tadio Gido had actually started to shoot Diamond Ring with somebody else.
Oh, wow.
Before he saw me at the University of Lagos, yes. And they just pulled that guy out and replaced me. So the same thing happened with this series I was supposed to call Solitaire. They were almost starting to shoot with two other guys and we auditioned together and I beat them to the role.
Wow.
And so I got the role. Acting again opposite RMD, again as father and son.
Imagine that.
So we spent this entire year acting what was going to be the biggest TV series in Africa. I mean, it was big. There was Barbara Soki, there was Kepi Ekpeyombasi, there was Funola Ofiyebi, there was Ireti Oladol, there was everybody. And I was in the lead role with RMB again, father and son. Wow. I mean, at that time, I looked like comedy should go and sit down. Okay. After this, I am set for life, and that is it. But ask me what happened. We did that for almost a year and a half, and it was never released. Never.
I wonder why.
That upset RMD. That upset RMD for the longest time. RMD was so upset.
Why was because it that released, was you too know?
Cheap. It was too expensive.
Oh, go figure.
It was so big that it could literally find no sponsors. And eventually they found a sponsor for it, and it ran on TV for a few weeks, and just when it started to gain momentum, for some reason it went off again.
Wow.
And at that point, I'm like, you know what? This is ridiculous. I cannot have acted with two of the three biggest directors in Nigeria in the lead roles in two of the three.
And you still can't have an acting career.
I still can't have an acting career. This is, now I'm done with this. Now I'm done. I'm done. So that's it in a nutshell.
Wow. So, of course, comedy now decided, so you finished school. I'm sure by this time you had finished school and you had decided that, okay.
I was partaking of the privilege that was reserved in University of Lagos. I was partaking of the privilege that was reserved for dilettantes, tramps, and lazy people. Yes. So that was what I was doing at that time. But my comedy career was picking up again. I came into comedy at the cusp of, at the time I was coming into comedy, there were maybe 10 established comedians. There were 10. There was Ali Baba, Mohamed Danjuma, Basoj Tarya, OK Bakasi. In fact, Julius Agu had just blown up at that time.
Wow.
Julius Agu was the thing that time. That was when Julius had just released these songs. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
You mean it was that long ago?
We came in at the cusp of that revolution. And so we became the star comedians, the mini celebrities of that time.
Wow. Imagine that. So, please, being that you were, or you still are, so successful, why in the world did you withdraw from comedy?
Because I believe in focus as a principle of success. I believe in doing one thing and doing only one thing and doing that thing extremely well. So it was that while I was acting, that was what I wanted to do, and I didn't brook any other. I didn't book any other suggestions. And the moment I decided that I was done with acting, then I dropped acting fully and I went on to comedy. I mean, you might as well have asked yourself that I could have taken a few other acting roles here and there, but I was done with that and I fully focused on comedy. And after doing comedy for about a decade, when I decided that it was time to do a TV show, then that was what I was going to do. I didn't want to focus on comedy again, so I stopped that and I went to do the TV show. And we did the TV show for a decade. And when I decided that, okay, it seemed as if it's time to wrap up the TV show and go do something else, and that is what I have done now. You know, I'm off to do something else. So that's how I usually would live my life as an example, as a living and breathing practice of focusing on one thing at a time.
So one track pony, Loroko. You like to throw all your energy into what you're doing at that point in time and give it the very best of you.
Well, yeah, you know, jack of all trades, master of none kind of thing, you know. If you're going to be a master of anything, you need to be focused on that.
Quite a few things, actually. Let's just clear that out right now. Because like you go ahead.
No, please.
Like you rightly said, so you are an accomplished actor. You've acted with two of the best movie makers in Nigeria to date. You are an accomplished comedian. You also you've pulled some of the greatest guests on the TV show that you hosted. How long did you host that for, by the way? I know 6 seasons in, it's like what, 6 years?
Well, seasons. I mean, we need to update that Wikipedia thing. It's now 9 seasons. That thing was written in 2017. So as of 2017, it was 6 seasons. Now it's 9 seasons.
Okay, so that's another 9 years. You're not that old now, brother. It's 9 seasons.
I started early. We started Tejumi Fish in 2010.
Yeah.
Tejumi Fish started in February 2010. So this year is 10 years.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And then I actually started early. I remember that a successful person once said to me that my parents must be very proud. He was saying this when I was about 29, that I've made such a big name for myself at 29. That how did I manage that? You know.
Wow. Wow. So please tell us, I know how dear your dad was to you, and I also kind of know the kind of influence that he had on your life. I mean, and it still shows through today. Tell us how that impacted your becoming the man that you are today.
So after God, my dad was just everything to me. My dad loomed largely in my life. I don't know how else to describe it. There was my dad was just a dominant factor in my life, and I can only hope that most people feel that way about their fathers. First of all, that was my father's character in life. He was a dominant, successful person. You know, he was the alpha male. If you ever heard the term alpha male, then that was my dad. You know, so he was the alpha male. He was the light in the room wherever he was. He was the man, and so that's how he was also in the family. He was the man in his family. He was the one who was the leading light of all his siblings. Well, in fact, he educated about just all of them. Wow. He was the firstborn of the family, who was quite older than the rest of them. So that we had my house when we were growing up was a veritable tribe of aunties and uncles, and you know, I mean. In our house, there must have been, so you've come to our house many times and you see how big that house is. It was built like that on purpose. I mean, because there were uncles and aunties on the foot all the time. Then there were drivers. And so that was who my father was. And for that reason, there was no way he wouldn't have influenced me as much as he did. And so his death was the greatest loss of my life up until now, and that's just it. I channel him in ways that I did not even know, so that a whole lot of the time when I speak, I find it weird that I'm sounding almost like him. It's as if a part of his spirit possessed me when he died.
Right.
You know, I was on my way to being that, but as soon as he died, it was as if, you know, maybe I shouldn't have been crying on the dead body, because it was as if I got something.
Like really, guy.
It was as if something. Yeah, it was as if something passed from that body to me. Mm. Yeah, there are times when I speak and I'm like, I did not just say that. It was Dad that said that. There was no way that was me who said that. And he was a Christian. He was a staunch Christian. The testimony of his life was that. It now looks short when I say it this way, but I was my father's son for only 33 years. It seemed like a lifetime, but when I think about it, it was like just 33 years. That was all that. Just 33. That was all that. You know, so, but the testimony of it is that in those 33 years, not once in 33 years did my father miss morning and evening prayers. My father would ring the bell every morning and every evening for us to have family prayers. I missed it many times. My mother missed it a couple of times. My siblings missed it many times. Not once in 33 years did my father miss prayers when he was at home. Not once.
Wow.
That is a testimony that I can't even begin to tell you.
Exactly.
Yes, not once in 33 years did my father miss morning and evening prayers. I mean, so go figure.
True. Very true. Those are big shoes to step into, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a father now, and I can't even tell you the number of evening prayers and morning prayers that I've missed, you know. So,
especially as you had a lifetime of them, you should not be missing them. This should be ingrained in your psyche.
Well, you see, here's the thing. I only know that when I became cognizant. So hopefully by the time this one's cognizant enough, which will be in about 2 years ahead, I'll have gotten my act, you know, far better together. And besides, it's their fault. You can't do morning and evening prayers with 2 screaming 2-year-olds running all over the place, wondering what you're doing, tearing up the Bible, throwing over the family bell, kicking the trees, pulling down the TV. I mean, it's not time for that yet.
Experimenting. So they're just getting to know the environment and all the things that are being pushed in their faces. They will get better, as you know.
Yeah, that's it's good. They're experimenting, so they will also experiment and find out what the cane is. You know, they experiment when they get to the cane.
They
experiment and
you
get to the cane and the slipper. You know.
So your love for Yoruba music, was that from your dad, or was that something that you discovered on your own? Because I don't think I'd met anybody before you who loved Yoruba music so much and knew how to sing all the words. I mean, the lyrics, sometimes, you know, I would just be looking at you and be thinking, how is this, as they describe you, young, dashing, long man, playing Yoruba music and singing along?
Okay, so I'm driving yesterday and I'm doing exactly that. And I'm just, okay, it was actually in the bathroom and I'm looking in the mirror and I'm like, man, I miss my dad so much. I mean, that was just yesterday. I was literally saying that just a couple of hours ago. I'm looking at the mirror and I say, God, Dad, I miss you so much. Because I'm listening to some of those music. And I remember how my dad used to substitute the name that Ebenezer Obiat sang in that song with his name, because he used to do that a lot. So I was singing, Odile Alare O Ninu Odun. You know, so that's what I was singing. So what Obiad actually said was, but two things, my father wasn't a Akoni and we weren't Muslims, so my father would substitute. So I can remember exactly where we were going when he said that. We were driving in his white Mercedes Benz and we were going to church one Sunday morning. Yeah, when he was singing that. So, yes, I got that definitely from my father and my family. My father did most of it, and then our drivers did the rest. You know, because we went to school in Apapa, we went to Corona School in Apapa, we were living in Ikeja.
Yes.
And that, back in those days, was a 30-minute drive, you know.
Yes.
It was a 30-minute ride, one way. So, every day, indoctrinated by your drivers in a particular kind of music over 8 years is a long time for any child.
Yes.
And then, I now went to Federal Government College, Ogbomoso. So Ogbomoso is some 3 hours, give or take a few minutes from Lagos.
Yeah.
That's a long time for 6 years to be indoctrinated in music by your drivers. So back and forth to Ogbomoso, and it's always Yoruba music. It's always Orlando or Kingsoni Adi or Ebenezer Obi or Ilomo Wura or something or the other. I mean, I had to pick that up. But having said all of that, I'm not an only child. I also have siblings.
We know.
But I'm the only one who seems to have...
Exactly. I was going to ask that question.
Yeah, I'm the only one who seems to have picked that up. So that's where our proclivities as human beings come in. We're different one from another. So that's my proclivity. I mean, I was just fascinated with the music. I was fascinated above all with Kingsoni Adi. And it's just the things that happen to us happen for a reason. Because if I didn't have that grounding in that music, the Teju Baby Face show would not have been possible, because that music was a critical part of that show. And so, you know, that's providential and predestination in a manner of speaking.
So how do
and
you
I enjoy it.
I know. If they don't know, they know now. You thoroughly enjoy it. So how did you feel when you first met KSA or Ebenezer Obi?
I felt like my career could end at that time and I'd be, you know, just happy.
Really?
I mean, I watched my first interview with Kingsoni Adi was good, but my second interview, I watched that interview at fact, when we finished the interview with King Sunny Ade in 2017, the second one, after we celebrated his birthday on the show, when the post-production room where they were editing the thing, and I looked at it and I looked at my staff and I said that I think we're done with the Teju Bibi show.
Wow.
They said, why? I said, where are we going to go after this? I said, how are we going to top what we've done in the last couple of years? We've just come around again and done King Sunny Ade the second time. I said, so where could we go? Who else could we interview on this show that could move the needle for us? And so they floated a couple of names. They came up with maybe three. And those names had to do with they were the president, the vice president, and the general overseer of the Redeemed Christian Church of God. I said, so you're making my point for me. I said, so this is where we've come to. We've come to the point now that nothing can move the needle. Then they mentioned General Obasanjo, Babangida. I mean, we came up with less than 10 names. Okay, so a few months later, I now had the opportunity to interview General Obasanjo at his farm, which we did. And so we're all excited about that interview, man. People are going to be blown away and all that. It didn't move the needle one bit.
Imagine that.
We'd come to the point where, you know, that's what was expected of us. Yeah, so after General Obasanjo's interview, I figured that, okay. And General Obasanjo's interview was an epiphanic moment for me, because I remember leaving that interview grateful, but also feeling a bit underwhelmed and cheated. Wow. I felt cheated because I couldn't ask him what I really wanted to ask him. Yeah. I couldn't really ask him what I wanted to ask. I was too scared. I was too afraid. And that's not me being chicken. He actually literally told me that before the interview.
Oh.
I remember as we were entering the lift in his farm to go to the floor where we'll conduct the interview, he said in Yoruba,
Wow.
Translation.
Yes, please translate. You better for those be careful about understand. Exactly.
Yeah, you better be careful about the types of questions you're going to ask, because if you just ask rubbish, I'm just, you know me, man. I trust myself. I'm just going to walk out. You know, and it didn't help matters that even before I got to that place, the people who had arranged the interview had said the same thing to me, and they had given me the pointed example of how just a couple of days ago some guys had come to interview him and they were asking him those questions, and he turned on those guys and looked at them first of all cursorily for about 10 seconds, and he just basically just let them have it and he walked off the set.
Wow.
I mean, so there I was having to, you know, I can't say exactly what I want to say, but plant my mouth on his very accomplished posterior, you know, just smushing all the way.
That must have been really hard for you.
No, really, I must balance it out, because on the other hand, again, this was an honor. I thoroughly enjoyed the interview. It's just that I would have liked to ask one or two things that I was too scared to ask.
True.
I felt very privileged that he would allow me to interview him. And, you know, that was it. But to the point I was trying to make, or that I'm trying to make, we did the interview with General Obasanjo, and it didn't move the needle at all, not one bit. It moved the needle with our sponsors. Our sponsors were at that time Dilly Darling. And once we submitted that interview, they just jumped out of the boat with cement blocks tied around their legs, you know, so... into the proposal we were.
I actually saw the picture of that. You know, that's not nice.
You know,
but so, I understand.
So,
right.
Yeah, so that was what that represented for us. Or that's what King Sunny Ade and Ebenezer Obey and all those. I was literally living out my dreams and my fantasies on that show. I was literally living out my fantasies. I used to, as a young man, listening to KSA's albums in my father's parlor, and I used to imagine what it would be like to dance with him, to sing with him, to talk to him. I used to think to myself that does he know that he has a fan somewhere who's just crazy about him? And for him to literally know that, not once but twice. I mean, you could ask him now, you could meet him anyway and ask him who his greatest fan is. While he might not see me first, I'm about to tell you that he's going to mention me somewhere in there.
True.
By the time he mentions three people, he's going to say Teju Bibi face. That is if he doesn't mention me first.
True.
That for me is a lot.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Okay, so you're writing. Why did you write? Did you feel that it was a way to give back? Was it something you had always wanted to do? Or did you think you could reach more people with what you had learned up to that point in life?
Okay, well, as a multi-talented person or a multi-potentialite, as I've discovered that people who have many talents are called, I suddenly discovered one day that I had the gift of pedagogy. Pedagogy doesn't actually seem right. A pedagogue is somebody who would, let's just say I had a teaching gift someday, you know. So I discovered, discovered that I had the ability to actually teach other people. And so I started to write down all the ideas for teaching that would come to me in hopes that one day I'd get the platform to begin to teach. And so I was writing for a couple of years, just waiting for the platform, when a friend of mine said, why don't you just release a book instead? And I said to him that, but I don't know what to say. Shouldn't you be established in the area in which you want to write before you write? Shouldn't you be an authority in the area before you write? And he pointed out something that should have been obvious. He said that actually it's the reverse. It's the fact that you write a book in an area that makes you an authority. Right. If you write an entire book in an area, then you must know about the area. He said, besides, you keep talking about all these things you've written on your computer that you're not teaching anywhere. So, and those, won't those things go into a book? And so that was an eureka moment for me. And so I started to put those things together in a book because I was convinced at that time that the next iteration of my career would be as a teacher. I was convinced at that time that given the way my career had gone with acting and then comedy and a talk show, that I was fully ripe now to begin to teach other people how to succeed in the entertainment space. And so, yeah, so perhaps it was time to write a book and put it out there and begin to do that. So that was what led to writing the book in the first place.
Wow.
So I need to ask at this point.
Yes.
I'm trying my best to get my global English going on. Am I coming across globally with the way I'm speaking? Please, we need to know now. Otherwise, I've wasted the last 1 year in America. Please, let's be clear.
So, let me clarify that. Are you speaking with an American accent or are you speaking with a Nigerian accent is what you want to know?
No, I'm speaking with a global accent. I'm speaking in such a way that anybody who listens to me from anywhere all over the world knows that this guy is he's traveled. This guy is educated and he's traveled the world and I can hear him well. I can hear him without a problem. That's what I'm going for.
Okay, so let me not be the one to answer this question. Let me ask the people that are in the studio with me. Temitope, is he speaking global English? Can you hear him clearly? Do you understand what he's saying? Do you understand what he's saying? He's coming across like he's educated, he's well traveled.
Yes.
She's saying, SOG. He said he can hear you clearly. So, and you're coming across as you have well traveled and educated.
No. That's not the question. That's not the question I asked, right? I didn't ask if they can hear me. Let me ask again. Of course, you could always hear me clearly,
yes.
And I was always educated, even though I asked that. I want to know if the way I'm speaking, it's obvious that, okay, there's some American influence in the way he's speaking, even though he's not American. I mean, African. That's what I want to know, because you could always understand me, and you guys are Nigerians, and even if I was speaking like this. So my father said to me that we should go to...
Hold on. One person I've just said that. Please, can you hear the influence of the globalization in his voice?
He's speaking like a Nigerian.
See? So, are you okay now?
What did he say?
He said you're speaking like a Nigerian.
That's a lie. Nigerians don't speak like this. What are you talking about?
Excuse me, I'm speaking
You that you answered that question just spoke like a Nigerian. This is how Nigerians speak. This one that I'm speaking now. This is how we speak.
Oh yeah. So your English is refined. But your English has always been refined.
No, I was just joking.
Of course we know you are just joking. That's why you have this inside of you. Of course we know you are just joking. Before you let me lose my train of thought now, let me be thinking of what it was I wanted to ask you. So you have done, so have you, do you, now this might sound a bit selfish, but it's not. It's more like keeping track. With your book and with your mentoring, I'm sure that, are there people whose lives you kind of help to move in the trajectory where they could give them the best of themselves? Are there people who you are proud of that you came in contact with and you were able to impact?
Well, they say that. I mean, I guess you have to ask them. They do say that they read me or they watched me or they saw something that I did and it impacted them and so on and so forth. We did sell quite a couple of my books, and I get those testimonies on social media here and there of people who say, you know what, I had an opportunity to read your book. I had, by the way, the person I said I was speaking Nigerian, did you hear opportunity there? You tell me the Nigerian that says opportunity. So you are speaking like Nigerian.
Should I tell them what the explanation you gave to me was when I said, oh man, so you both. You say, if you don't want them to be repeating the thing that you are saying 20 million times, looking at you as if you are speaking Greek. So
when you go somewhere here, I say, you say, excuse me, sir, please, I'm looking for the authority in charge. They look at you like, excuse me, what? You say, yes, I'm trying to quote a man told me, and I'm trying to quote him verbatim. They look at you like, what? So you have to laugh. Say, I'm trying to quote him verbatim. You know, I'm trying to quote him verbatim, and I'm looking for the opportunity. So they come to me, like, I had the opportunity to read your book, and, you know, sir, I just want to let you know that I was blessed, and so on and so forth. And so I guess a couple of people have been helped, really. And then there are some of these guys who come up who are stars now, who say they saw. I remember when I was interviewing Ricardo Banks, who said that he remembered that the show used to be on Tuesdays, and he'll come in from a school or wherever, and he'd sit down with his family, and they'd watch the Teju Babyface show, and that, you know, influenced him and all. So you see all those things. And besides, you don't need for those people to come up to you. You best believe that there are people that you've, you know, impacted one way or the other with your career, whether or not you know or you knew that they were looking at you. There are going to be all those people. And so the beauty of your life, of our lives, or the tragedy, God forbid, of lives, is that you're going to find out when it's too late that you were actually influencing people and you never knew.
Yeah.
One of my greatest fears that I've learned now, and that's one of the tokens of wisdom, when God gives you wisdom, that's one of the tokens of wisdom, is for you to know that you need to understand and appreciate and acknowledge where you are in life. You know how they say stop to smell the roses,
yes,
and you must stop to enjoy the moment. Most of us never stop to enjoy the moments until the moments are passed, and then we look back and we regret those moments. So here's the thing that I have discovered. You should actually live in the moment, not because you're not going to move on to tomorrow, but you should live in the moment to enjoy the moment, because again, as they say, you're going to regret if you do not. But at the very least, if you do not enjoy the moments, at least acknowledge the moment.
True.
Even if you cannot appreciate it, acknowledge where you are. Because a great man once wrote that a man in honor who does not know is like the beasts that perish. It's like the animals that perish. So you don't want to be here some 20 years, some 30 years down the line when you're 70 and young people come up to you and say you influence them so much, and then you're looking like, oh, I never knew I did that. Oh, I never knew I did that. Oh, if only I had known that I did that, then perhaps I would have taken my life more seriously.
Yes.
You know, you want to take your life serious enough to acknowledge the moments in which you live and understand that you're influencing other people, even though you might not know or might not see those people. Who knows who's listening to this interview right now, who's going to be influenced?
True. Very true. Very true. Okay, so slight trivia. What do your family, your siblings especially, and I know your mother adores you, your siblings especially, how do they feel about, I mean, when you blew up, for lack of a better phrase, let me rephrase, when you became famous, how did your family take that?
Well, my father wasn't, as you might imagine, impressed initially. But my siblings were cool. Again, it's in the sense that you really must have problems if you stroll into your house and you suddenly start behaving like you're a star. You know, you must really have some really, really deep-rooted, you must have some deep-rooted problems. Your problems must be rooted deep. You know, if you stroll into your house one day and you're like, I'm Teju Babyface, you're better recognized, you know, the problems must really be deep-rooted. So it's in the sense that you don't see yourself any differently from your family. It's also that it's your family that knows who you are, because what you put on outside is just a partner. It's a partner of it's a chain. It's like it's branded. It's your family that really knows who you are. They know what it took you to get here. They knew your broke days and your broke nights. They know you really. So you're not that guy. Now, on the other hand, they are also happy for your success, which only begins to occur to them when they hear other people. So the way it's strange to you to hear people celebrate you, that's how it's also strange to your family. Because so your family goes outside and they hear, oh, are you Teju Babyface's brother? Oh, why, I love him. And so it takes your brother a minute to say, yeah, you love who? Brother, you?
So true.
It also takes them a minute to get used to this celebrity as well. True. You are getting used to the celebrity. It also takes your family a minute to get used to the celebrity as well. So then that's that. But then the more that happens for them, the more they become prouder and prouder of you. You know, so they say that they're your brother, they say they're your sister, they say they're your... I remember a couple of months before my father died, we had an appointment in a hospital to see a specialist.
Yes.
And so we're coming from different ends of the town. My parents were coming from the mainland. I was coming from the island, and we were to meet at the hospital. And my parents happened to get to the hospital before me, and so they had gone in to see the doctor. And so I arrived later, of course. So I was introduced into the doctor's office, and as soon as the doctor looked up and saw me, he said, hi, you're Teju Babyface. I said, yeah. And he looked at my dad and said, wow, that's your son? And my father smiled, and he said, well, Terubaku, Tinabaku, Afirubuju. Translation, our worthy children carry on our legacy in a nutshell. And that was a watershed moment for me. That was a hallmark moment for me, because my father was saying this a couple of months before he died. So first of all, I should have been sentient enough. I should have been wise enough and sentient enough to know that he was dropping hints. But again, with everybody who's lost a loved one, they drop hints all over the place. But you never pick up on any of those hints until they die.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when you start seeing all the writing in the wall that they were trying to tell you, all the writing. Like, hey, hello, hello, I'm going, hello. No, you never see any of that.
You don't, truly.
You know, so.
Like if I would live
again. Yeah, so that was the first reason why that was... an epoch-making moment for me. Then it was also the fact that this man who did not see the light of my career and did not support my career would finally, in the last moments of his life, acknowledge that I'd stepped into a position that was greater, that was a greater position than he was in, which is saying something, because my father was very successful. So for my father to be saying that I was taking over from him, and that I was more successful than him, which was what he was saying in a nutshell, is just amazing. It was just amazing for me.
True. All right. So I'm going to ask about because you seem to have done everything at an age when most people didn't know who they were. When you decided that you were going to get married, what propelled you? Because you guys have been married for, what, like almost a decade now, I think? Is it that long?
It was 8 years in September.
Okay. So what propelled you? I mean, people, guys, let me be bold to say, guys in your generation are not thinking of settling down at that time. Why did you?
Well, you see, the thing is that you are deceived by the baby face, because actually, the truth is that the guys in my generation were settled down. Basket Mouth had married 2 years before me. Holy Malam had gotten married 5 or 6 years before me. ONG had gotten married 3 years before me. Kofi had gotten married 3 years before me. Bumi Davies had gotten married. Of course, Bumi was considerably older than I was, but Bumi had gotten married 5 years before me. Kayode had gotten married. I mean, Kayode was way older than I was, but Kayode had gotten married a year before me. Who else was my guy? I mean, all my guys were getting married. They were having children, so, I mean, they were married. And then you must remember that I got married at 33, so I wasn't exactly young. I got married at 33. I wasn't young. I might have looked it, and if I'd known that it was going to take 6 years for us to have children, I mean, if I'd had the power of God at that point, then I probably would have gotten married at 33. But on the other hand, I would have missed out on spending six beautiful years with my wife,
true,
whom I love dearly. You know, so I didn't exactly marry young. 33 was, as far as my father was concerned,
I was just messing up. I can imagine.
Yes, I was just messing up. 33, that's ridiculous. I wasted it on a friend of mine came to see me at home. And this was when I was 20. I think I was 28 or so. And so my father had. Let me try to remember that story exactly the way I want to tell it. So I think I was 27 or so. And so my friend had come to meet me at home. And so my father had said, "Hi, how old are you?" And the guy had said, 30. So my father now said, 30, great. So when are you going to get married? And he was asking him, not because of him, of course. He was asking him because of me. So because I am 27, this guy is 30. So my father says, when are you going to get married? So the guy said, I'm thinking when I'm about 34, sir. My father said, that's nice. Don't you think that's too early? Why don't you wait until when you're 30?
The guy must have been embarrassed if nothing else. Oh, my word. Oh, wow.
That's, don't you think that's early? Why don't you wait until you're 40?
Oh, wow. So,
yeah.
So you got the message and at then, some point in time or something.
Yeah, and then I also wanted to get married for my parents. Now, people will tell you that you shouldn't do that, and you shouldn't. That shouldn't be the sole reason why you should get married, but it should be a consideration, which was why it hurts me that my father actually died before my wedding. My father died just about 9 months before we got married, actually. So I also wanted to get married for my parents, because none of my siblings were married yet.
Yeah.
And my parents were getting old. So I wanted them to have that day that they had looked forward to for a long time, which sadly my father missed out on. But as much as that was a consideration, we also had to wait for the right fit, the right match, which was why I waited till 33, actually. So to actually answer your question, if things had actually worked out the way I was hoping, I'd have actually gotten married about 30 or 31, actually. It just didn't work out with the person I thought I was going to marry. And then that was why it now had to wait till I was 33.
Wow. Explain the joy of fatherhood, especially with double blessings.
Okay, the joy of fatherhood is, contrary to what you think, at least for me, wasn't in the moment the children were born. Because people talk about how they were in the hospital and then their child was born and they saw their child come out of their wife and, you know, and the baby was placed in their hands and their life, they just experienced the paradigm shift and it was an epiphanic moment and all that. Nah, it was none of that for me. What it was for me was, I thought that was what it was going to be.
Okay.
But what it was for me was panic and concern and fear.
Oh, wow.
Fear because we'd waited all this time and for 9 months we'd just been praying, God, please just let her carry this pregnancy to term. And that's when you start reading everything on the internet and everything on Google about how multiple pregnancies are at risk and the risk of miscarriage and all that sort of tosh, you know. So there's all that. I just can't wait for these babies to be born. When these babies are born, I'll just be so relieved, I'll be so happy, and all the stress is going to pass over. And that's what you think. But the moment they're born, unless you are actually thinking about it, and again, that's what I'm saying, learn to acknowledge the moment. Unless you acknowledge the moment, you will not know when you will pass from one level into another level of worry. One worry is just going to replace the other one automatically. Automatically, one level of worry is going to replace another one automatically without you knowing. So I went from... What did you say?
It was Temitopedes speaking your global English.
Oh, automatically. That's what I'm saying. Tell your brother in the studio that I was speaking like that. Maybe he has. Maybe he needs to take a shot of Paraga. You're not quiet on. This one I'm speaking now is Nigerian English. You are not. Why are you beefing? Look. Why are you beefing me?
Sorry. Don't
beef me. I can understand how getting a visa to come to America or anywhere is hard right now in Nigeria. Here, they are not giving out any visas in Nigeria right now. No visas. The only embassy that is giving visas. Yeah, the only embassy that is giving visas in Nigeria right now is Christ Embassy. You know, so... automatically, I had to learn that as well. Automatically, it sounded weird a few times I said it the first time. I'm like, this is automatically now. This thing is automatically now. What is automatically? But hey, that's it. So you automatically pass from one level of worry to the other. So I passed from worry that the pregnancy was carried to term to immediately start worrying that the children survived.
Wow.
That's what I passed to immediately, because they were twins, and as anybody who's had multiple births can tell you, sometimes they will come in before term.
True.
And then they will be small.
True.
And so my son was normal big, but my daughter was small, and so they had to take her to go weigh her and all of that, and she just passed that, that weighing test by just it wasn't an ounce. What's that thing? It's 4 ounces and whatever. Okay. I've forgotten the other part of that measurement, but she just skipped it by just one or two measurements. Ooh. If she had been any smaller than she was, they'd have put her in the incubator.
Yes.
You know, So I went from anxiety about losing the pregnancy to anxiety about the children surviving. You know, and then all the things you have to. Did you know that children don't breastfeed automatically?
Yes.
Do you know? I thought that none do. None.
Oh, none.
As in, I thought none. I thought that children come out of their mothers, babies, and you just put them to the breast and they just open their mouths and start to suck. That's not what happens. They just want to sleep. They've been used all their lives, which is now 9 months or whatever, to being fed automatically, through their mother's through the umbilical cord, right? Mm. So now you have to teach them to suckle and to hold on to the teeth. It's actually, they have a nurse in all these hospitals that they call the suckling nurse.
Oh, wow.
Who actually comes to train the mothers to have the baby suck. Now, this is where it is different. Some babies pick it up easier than others, and some other babies, it's just a stress. Now, so you can imagine when you have twins who have to suckle at the same time.
Wow.
Who didn't want to suckle? So that's one problem on one hand. Then the other problem is your wife has to start lactating. Believe it or not, lactation or lactating doesn't happen automatically either. You know, it doesn't just happen. So some people don't start lactating for a few days, and they're just all these complications you have to go through, and they are bringing in bills in dollars, and they are bringing in bills in dollars. So I'm sorry, that whole hospital experience for me, while I was joyful, of course, I was also contending with a lot of, hey, Jesus, back into your lung.
They don't come and they grow up by your jaw. Please, like that. Eat quickly, let's go home.
You know, so, I mean, I was joyful. But how has it changed me? It changed me thereafter. So I look at those children, and the joy they give you is just unimaginable. And because I've learned, because God has taught me to appreciate and acknowledge the moments, I learned to acknowledge the moments, which is why I take every moment, every hug, every smile. I just walk in sometimes to look at them sleeping. I just look at them sometimes playing. I acknowledge those moments. It's a joy because it's a pain in the behind. It's a stress. It's stress that you have to take care of the children. And so parents say stuff like, I hope when you're older, you will not forget me. In fact, I remember that my stepmom used to sing a song for us in Ekiti language. Sorry, Ekiti. You can't say Ekiti.
No.
There's no Ekiti. Ekiti.
Yeah.
You can't say Ekiti. Sorry. It's Ekiti. Whether I'm speaking American or not, you can't say Ekiti. So my stepmom used to sing in the Ekiti language a song that basically went, you can't, don't forget me when you are grown. Manya ye, oh mommy, manya ye. And you know, she'd sing, I mean, I don't know that I have time to sing the entire song for you. But basically is that, look, I suffered and I toiled over you. So when you're grown, my child, do not forget me. But the truth of the matter is that children are ingrates. They are just ingrates, including I, who is speaking to you.
True.
For all the stress that our mothers go through and our fathers, we don't even do half. We don't even come close to appreciating them.
True.
When we're teenagers, we think they are imposing upon us and we can't wait to leave home, and then we call them once a week. We're just ingrates. And I realize that that's exactly how this is going to pan out as well.
True.
Now, some children are nicer than others,
yeah,
but we don't do nearly enough, you know. And that was when I got the wisdom, where God gave me the wisdom. You see, God told me that, you see, there are two things. First of all, you're getting as much out of this relationship as they are.
True.
Even though it's stressful to take care of them and wipe their bum and all that. Can I ask you a question? Why did you want a child? Why were you so sad when you didn't have a child? Why did you want a child? Why did it mean the heavens and the earth to you to have a child? Because it was going to scratch an itch and answer a need for you too as well.
Okay.
That's number one. Then number two, you also get joy when you walk home and you see them and they hug you. And you are also enjoying this. So don't be like this is a one-way thing. Stop saying you're the one who is giving. They are also giving you joy, even though what they're giving you is unconscious on their part. And it's by omission, not by commission. But you're getting something out of this. So that's the first thing. The second thing is also the fact that you do for your children so that they can pay it forward. You need to look at your family as a dynasty. You are a generational concern in the hands of God, which is why God talks about dealing with families in generations. It is a selfish person or a person who is blind or a visionless person that thinks it is about them. It is about your family line. It's about your generation. God is doing something in your generations. When you come along, you take that vision, you take that mission of God, you take it much further, and then you hand it over, you hand the baton over to the next generation. So when you're training your children, you're not training them so that they can turn around and pay you back. You are training them so that they can pay it forward to the next generation and fulfill the mandate of God for your family and for your generations. That's just what it is.
Wow. We need to use that as a soundbite. We need to play that again and again and again. Wow. Okay, I was going to say, what are your last words? But perhaps, I don't know if anything will top that. But, as it is now past the hour, what would you say to, being that your life has been, so to speak, providential and let's just stick with providential. The other Yimbo skips my mind. What would you say to someone who is in the cusp of moving from one thing to another and is kind of thinking, I can't leave this. This is what feeds me. If I go into this and I do not make it, what would happen? Because a lot of people don't explore their options or the gifts that they have. We all seem to believe that God only gave us one gift. Meanwhile, he's given us a variety of gifts, but like you have managed to do with his help, you have honed it and done those in phases. What would you say to someone like that?
Okay, so I guess that those will be my last words on this program. You know, not my last words. When you said that, I was like, last words. So my last words on this program.
Yes.
All right. As to moving from one level, one iteration of your gifts to the next,
yes.
Let's just say, first of all, that most people never do this. Okay, never, never, ever, ever do this. And my greatest concern in my career, if I've had one concern in my career, in fact, one of the greatest concerns of my life, it is right up there with getting saved and getting married and having children and being good in God and all that. I guess the next greatest thing about my life and career is that I fear for some of the decisions that I've taken, I fear being forgotten. You know, I fear being forgotten. I fear obscurity. I fear obscurity. It is in my mind's eye a great tragedy to be forgotten, in the sense that you used to be impactful, then you're no longer impactful, and they no longer hear about you. You know, when I think of the great actors and the actresses and the musicians and all the famous people whom I used to know and hear about coming up in the industry, whom you never hear about again. You know, that was my greatest fear as, you know, as a brand. But, you see, until you conquer that fear and until you give that fear to God, you're going nowhere.
True.
Because as long as that is a fear, you're going to do everything to make sure that that doesn't happen. And as long as you're doing everything to make sure that that doesn't happen, that is eventually going to happen. Why? Because Jesus said that unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains just as it is. But if it falls down and it dies, it brings forth much more. At some point, you're going to have to be willing to live experientially that which you have recited many times over in church and in your quiet moments. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he will be with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. There are many shadows of death, but that career death, that momentous career death for a moment, is going to be one of the things you're going to have to go through if you're actually going to fulfill destiny. If you fear being forgotten, even for a moment, and you must always be there, and you must always be relevant, and they must always hear from and about you, then your career has a terminal date on it. It has an expiry date. Wow. Unfortunately for you, at some point your career is going to go through the shadows of death. At some point in your career, your career is going to go through the wilderness. At some point, they're not going to hear about you. So you can either choose to do God's way and go through the wilderness God's way and let him bring you out on the other hand. On the other end, bigger than you are. Did I just say hand just now?
Very, very, very robust. But it's okay.
Sorry. Even though I'm trying to get this American thing on, the Yoruba man still tries to come
I
in.
I can see that.
You know. But I corrected myself, yes, so please put that on record.
That's on record.
Besides, it's not for nothing that Yoruba people say that Olokupo Irolomua, when you're talking a lot, you're bound to make. when you speak a lot, you're bound to make things. I actually do that on TV, actually. Whenever I'm watching anybody on TV, especially Americans, they make mistakes, and I always rewind and record that part.
Yeah,
the guys on CNN.
You're human now. Of course they do. So I don't understand why it's such a big deal for us not to make mistakes. We're not perfect.
We're not perfect, but you see, we're not brought up to think that these guys who actually are the owners of the language make those mistakes.
True, very true.
You know, and I see them do it on CNN. I always rewind and record. Hey, Wolf Blitzer just said orange. Yay. That woman just said egg.
Oh, Lord,
so you're always going to go through that moment in your career where you're forgotten. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, forgotten is going to be in different levels, but there's always going to be that point where you have to calm down for a while. So you are either going to allow God do it for you in faith, or you're going to refuse and keep running and running and running and going to run out of steam. The problem when you run out of steam by yourself is that's it, you've run out of steam, and that which you should have done easily. So imagine you going through a reinvention when you're in your 30s, as opposed to you going through a reinvention when you're in your 60s.
Hmm.
When you go through it when you're in your 30s, you have your 40s and your 50s to make it up. When you go through it when you're 60, what can I tell you?
Exactly.
So if you're watching, if you're listening to this right now and you're afraid to explore your gifts, hey, just put your faith in God and do what you have to do. At some point, look, somebody said yesterday I was watching something on YouTube, and a preacher said yesterday that, do you want to be hot? Do you want to be hot or do you want to be great? You can either be hot or you can be great.
Sure.
Okay? You can be hot or you can be, yeah, that's what they say, it's hot.
Yes,
it's not hot. You can be hot.
We understand globally.
Yeah. Great. Because when I didn't understand it, I'm like, hot. Hot is what they wear on the head. No, I didn't get it. So you can either be hot. I can be a filler. What do you mean I can be hot? So you can either be hot or you can be great. If you're going to be great, then unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains as it is. You must dive to one level to go to the next level. If you can't do that, then I'm sorry. Eventually, you're going to go into obscurity. They're going to forget you. That, in the words of Job, you're going to say one day that which I fear the most has come upon me. Yeah.
And I read that just this morning. Right.
There you go. Look at me, man of glory.
I still remember you with Romans 8:28. Every time I read Romans 8:28, I remember you. For some reason, yes, that was the first Bible verse you quoted to me. I was thinking, Benny, you know the Bible. Really? Wow.
So when did I quote that to you?
I can't even remember. I think it must have been in the first few months that we met. I don't know what it was we were talking about. And I was like, hmm? Even, you didn't even have to bring the Bible to say it. I was pretty impressed.
Romans 8:28. What's in Romans 8:28, by the way? Romans 8:28 is that part of the Romans 8:28 is that part of the Bible that talks about them whom he foreknew he predestined and them whom he predestined. That's that whole part of the Bible. So, yeah, it's that part of the Bible. I just can't remember what 28 said. 28 is somewhere in between the cusp of the Holy Spirit praying for us and what shall we do to lose, to fall out of God.
Emil, my brain, as much as my brain is very good, sometimes it does not pick up distance. So let me look for Ben. Tori mo does not mean that. Okay, but I'm reading message version, Sha. So that's why sure that every detail in our lives is of God and is worked into something good. So let me translate it to
all things work together
for good.
All things work together.
Ben, you're all right. Sure, Bible. You know your Bible. You're a good guy. Okay, I'm going to let you, you can't go back to sleep again, unfortunately, but I'm going to thank you very much for your time. I knew this was going to be good. We have run over by 18 minutes, 13 minutes, one of the two, Sha. And that normally says that it's a very good interview. Not that the ones that end at 1 hour are not. It's just that. It's you. I know you. Yes. Just to allay the fears of those people that might be listening and thinking, so because now another 1 hour, they now tend to say it's not a good interview. It truly is. Thank you, Tedru. Thank you. I'm so not used to calling you Tedru, but let me just call you Tedru. Thank you, Tedru Babyface. Thank you for spending your morning with us.
Tedru.
Some people call him Tedru. I am you, Baja. Thank you so much for spending your morning with us. A Merry Christmas and a fantastic blessing-filled New Year to you and yours. May you continue to grow in His grace and in His strength, and may you always yield to Him in whatever aspect that He positions you. In the mighty name of Christ Jesus.
Amen.
Sashino, God bless you.
Amen. Thank you very much. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you guys.
Thanks. Thank you. Ama Siso. Peace. I'll be lost. Thank you. God bless you. Thank you. Wow. Oh my word. Truly, there's some sound bites in that interview that are going to come back. And it is enlightening to speak to people who understand the value that God has placed in them for them to pay forward. There's nothing more, I don't know the word to use. There's nothing more, I think it's loving. I think maybe it's love is the word. There's nothing more loving that a human being can do for the next human being than to bring the experiences that God has taken you through and paid forward to somebody who least expects it. That was our interview with Teju Babyface, the king of talk, also known, or Christian Badewonuola, or Lateju Oyelaki. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back to sign off for the afternoon. Weekend Nigeria, Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.
Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.